Welcome to a brand new podcast from the Deep Dive Podcast Network. I'm Andy Tarnoff, the host of Deep Dive MH370, and we're kicking off a new podcast called Wine Acoustics. I'm joined by Courtney Taylor Taylor, the lead singer, founder, can we call you?
Yep.
Lead guitar Pete, player of the Dandy Warhols, co-founder. And what I discovered this summer is Courtney Taylor Taylor is not just an accomplished musician, he's also a wine expert. Welcome, Courtney.
I would say I'm an expert wine drinker. there's so
that
many
we demonstrated,
things I don't know. Yeah, there are tons of things, but it is kind of like making music. To bring that right in off the top, the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know. You don't realize how much you don't know.
Well, that's why we're doing this podcast. And the reason we're calling it Wine Acoustics is because it's kind of the Venn diagram between tasting, learning about wine, drinking wine, and also how it fits into music and your backstory and everything you've learned in the last 30 years of wine drinking.
30 just to years give of a little drinking. Bit
of, well, maybe more than 30 years of drinking, but at least a lot of that has been in going through this wine journey. I just want to give a quick background because people are seeing this for the first time, how this came to be, Courtney. And it started after your Summerfest show in Milwaukee at the end of June. We went out to dinner. We went to a restaurant called Good Kind.
Yeah, Good Kind. Fantastic.
It's a Portland chef who came back to Milwaukee. We ate some great food with the band, but we also drank a shit ton of wine. And that's when I said to you, dude, we should do a wine podcast.
I tend to get elected team leader when it comes to wine drinking. So we drank some great wines and we drank some not great wines. I think there's only one that tasted like sour beer. But as far as the rest of them, we had great bubbles, we had great whites and great rosé.
Yeah, oh, and then we moved on.
We had a Spanish wine.
Right.
Yeah, because there is definitely a Spanish influence. You know, she used to be the chef at a restaurant called Colosso. And the owner, okay. Julie Colosso, dated our light guy, who's been with us for, I don't know, 20 years.
Is that Poopy?
Poopy, yeah.
Poopy, all right.
But anyway, so they were together, and she was the owner of that restaurant, and they would meet us on tour, the gang from Colosso Restaurant, the chef, the head cook, the head waiter, and Julie.
Yeah.
Because they would go around, she would take them around to Portugal, Spain, Italy, and meet, anyone, restaurant owners, farmers, and get back to their homes and cook with them. And they would write recipes down for her and say, oh, you're going to love this, try this at home. And, oh, you will love, you know. And we got to experience some great food and wine with the Colosso people. And then... obviously we lost the great chef and she moved to your town and opened Good
Kind. Sorry about that.
But it was interesting, tasting all those foods and dishes and some of them were pretty close to identically, regular things that we would order and eat there 20 years ago.
That's awesome.
That was a cool thing, yeah.
So before we start drinking wine, which is going to be one of the best parts of this podcast, I don't know about for
any,
the viewers.
Any
the
occasional
listeners.
Funny thing we say will be probably the best parts of this podcast.
Right, and the more wine we drink, the funnier it should get, theoretically. But just to establish your credentials just a tiny bit, and then we'll get into the wine. We'll talk about other stuff also. You also own a wine bar, wine shop in Portland, right?
So, Portland.
Okay. And that's in within the auditorium complex that you and the Dandy Warhols have built. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place like people can go and.
Yeah. It's just at the front corner, you know. The studio is in a different part of the building. The studios, okay. We have a series of little different recording areas and rooms.
All right. I'm looking forward to seeing that when the Dandy Warhols do their 30th anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be fun.
Gala,
we'll do one of these
thing.
Live in Portland together.
Yeah. It's a really good idea.
I shouldn't right, say, yeah. Live,
not, but near live, like live. I don't know what they call that. At any rate, we picked a. So I'm in Milwaukee. Courtney, you're in Portland. So this is kind of an interesting technical challenge because we got to get the exact same wines, exact same cheese, exact same crackers. So we're
tasting. We want to have the exact same size glass, so we have more or less exactly the same culinary experience. So
it's highly scientific.
That's why we're going with BV. This is a very, very famous winery, maybe the first true smash hit on a national scale that Napa produced at all, BV. And here's the bottle, da da da.
So 2020 vintage that we both have.
Which is nice because 4 years is a good amount of time. You know, 5 years is just off the cuff. What people say is when it becomes what it's supposed to be, starts becoming, you know, the wine it was meant to be.
Okay.
Now, I don't know. Napa wines, I don't have the best history with Napa wines because they're generally jammy and fruit bomby and fruit forward or whatever you want to call that phenomenon. But I think this is one of the legendary, you know, Napa cabs. So, and they have been making for 100 years. And I think the trend of fruit bombs only started in the '90s. So if they have stayed true to form, you know, and on the straight and narrow path of making, you know, more Bordeaux style Cab Sauv, then it's going to be a great wine. It might be jammy at first, and sometimes they, in the first 20 minutes or even 10, the thick, flabby low end starts to tighten up and become, you know, fantastic wine shaped.
I have so many questions for you, so many things I want to talk about, but since you mentioned that this wine is going to change, it probably makes sense that we should
open
this
now,
thing
and
start talking about it. Okay.
Cool.
Want to open some wine?
All right. Foiler alert. Oh, well, I didn't need the foiler. For those of you who don't know, on the classic Somme key, which it looks like this, there is a foiler blade, which is not, you know, there it is. Okay.
So a weapon.
Yeah, it's not a weapon. I think they're even allowed on airplanes.
Okay.
I'm not going to try and find out.
No, it's probably for the best. Although you are heading on your European tour, probably by the time this episode drops, you'll be drinking wine in Switzerland or something.
Let's call it released. Somehow, we used to release records. Now we drop them. And I don't know how that happened, but I don't love it.
You don't like the word drop?
I didn't say that. I said we used to release records, and I would like to keep releasing records, and I'd like to release these podcasts as well.
And we're going to.
That's all I'm saying. Wow, this all has a great nose. I mean, it's not fruity on the nose. It's just big, peppery, spicy. That is, wow. Okay, I'm excited about this. I've never had a BV that I know of in my life. And I've driven by the beautiful mansion in, I believe it's on the Rutherford Shelf, which is a pretty highly sought after piece of dirt. And I saw that they have a few Rutherford, you know, specific wines. I don't know if this is one, but, you know, it's down the highway from St. Helena, which is the heart and soul of Napa Valley.
I do have some background on this vineyard.
And you
called it.
Lay on.
They source the majority of the cab from Napa Valley's Rutherford, Calistoga, and St. Helena appellations. The diverse soils and microclimates, as well as the various clones of Cabernet Sauvignon and cultivation techniques, contribute to this wine's complex flavor profile.
Wow, I love that. That's a really tidy description. Not showy or flamboyant. That's a I like the way they talk.
So you smell pepper in this?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I smell it.
Like a colored, like green pepper, maybe, but not like a Cab Franc. Cab Franc is notoriously a green pepper red wine. This one, I don't know. There's just, it's so busy that I can't tell. It just really, it's sending me. I'm having a romantic, you know, nearly religious experience smelling this thing. It is gorgeous.
That's pretty great for a $35 bottle of wine.
Yeah.
So if it's giving you a religious experience for $35, and we're doing something right here.
Yeah.
Should we taste it?
I'm afraid to dispel the magic, but okay, here, we got to clear the palate with
identical crackers here for science.
Identical crack. That is a great cracker. What is the brand of this? I love it. These Italian style.
I opened it up already.
Olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
La Panzanella.
Could be.
Is that what it's called? Do you remember?
I'll put a research team on that.
Yeah, you will.
We don't have a research.
Okay, I'm going in.
We kind of have a research term.
I'm going in.
Okay, let's do it.
Only cracker. Cracker only. Cracker commandos. That's what a perfect wine. It's not flabby or jammy or stupid in any way. Oh my.
I don't taste any of that. No.
God. I can't believe have this experience for $35. I had no idea. This is crazy.
Wine acoustics, baby.
Wow.
Now, what I've learned from you is this wine is going to change.
It'll soften up. It's got a bit of a, you know, tannic, but the tannins aren't screaming your face off or anything. You know, the tannins are the very top note, the dry, chalky, that's tannin. Right below mm-hmm. that is high mid-range, which would be called acid. And then the warm mid-range is fruit. And then I generally think that the lowest note will be alcohol. The basiest base note is going to be alcohol.
Because I tasted the alcohol taste, but maybe
it's definitely there. I think what we're going to see happen is we're probably both going to be buying a lot of the entry level BV Cab Sauv.
Hell yeah, I am.
This is really a rare find. I mean, I've tasted 10,000 bottles of wine. I don't know. I'm for years, I've been the youngest member of a wine club that included and still includes a bunch of them. The original 1970s winemakers of Oregon that were just weirdos, basically, that moved here.
Portland Dick Erath, weirdos? Okay.
Dick Ponzi, the Adelsheims. There, you know, just this whole slew of half a dozen, maybe. And they, like, Erath came from the tech world. He dropped out of a great career making buku bucks in the tech world. And I had lunch with him privately, as well as sat next to him anytime I could at the wine lunch. And there was about 55 of us. And they were all in that generation that were then, you know, when I started maybe 15 or more years ago, they were in their 70s, moving into their 80s, and a lot of them have gone now. Bill Stoller is, I haven't seen him, but I think he's still alive. Stoller is a fantastic Oregon, very successful winery, great Chardonnay. I love that. Not much of a Pinot drinker. Anyway. I can't even remember where I started. But everybody would bring a bottle. And we would meet once a month. And I've been doing this for, you know, a decade and a half, maybe more. So that was the most immersive wine learning experience, besides traveling with the dandies and ordering a different bottle from a different region and a different country pretty much every day. I have tasted a ton of wines, and then of course gone to a lot of wineries, taken the tour, friends with winemakers, and asked them a lot. And I still just don't know so much about winemaking, and I'm really only talking from experience, not from any arcane or scientific even knowledge about it.
But that's the thing about wine, right? It's a personal experience that, you know, I'm gonna let you guess what the alleged notes are, or bouquet rather is, but it really doesn't matter. Okay, now this is right?
You know what's more important than what it actually smells like is what era the writer is from. Now, is it BV's writer, like the same writer that you already read from?
I have multiple sources here. I got Jim Gordon, wine enthusiast. Don't know who he is.
No, Jim Gordon is probably 100 years old and can't smell anymore.
Okay. And I also have their own description, so we can compare.
Let's go to a different one. Somebody like a, you know, I think Wine Spectator is generally consistent and legit. If you're going to go with a magazine, let's go Wine Advocate and Wine Spectator. Do you have those?
Okay. I mean,
I think Wine Spectator I think they're going to say Black Cherry, Blackberry, Stone Fruits. And black pepper.
Okay. That's impressive, because according to the vineyard itself, it says darker tones of blackberry, called it acai berry. I haven't eaten enough acai other than like in smoothies to tell you for sure what that tastes like.
Cool.
But dark plum, stone fruit, and more subtle notes of violet crushed rose petal, red rose petal, and black pepper spice.
Yeah, I got the numbers.
You could be doing this. Now, according to Jimmy Gordon, wine enthusiast, I'm calling him Jimmy Gordon.
Jimmy Gordon.
He says, focus and brilliant flavors of red and black cherries, black currants, minty, toasty, tobacco-like accents.
Huh.
I don't know. I'm not sure I get any of those. Tobacco?
No, not yet. I mean, they might be revealed later. How drunk do you suppose old Jimmy was when he wrote that?
Well,
when he
let
tasted
me just,
that.
Let me just put this in perspective.
When he smelled that.
He gave it a 93.
Yeah, I would give it a 93 for sure. So 93 is a healthy,
drunk.
Healthy number in wine reviews, and it's not easy to get.
Okay. All right. So I'll keep looking up some other reviews here, but while I do that, I was hoping you could tell.
This is a really great, and it's, I want to say simple because it's really straightforward, but it's not. I mean, it really does have a great, like, I feel like I'm drinking a far more expensive wine than I am.
Good. Then we're doing our viewers a service here, because again, we're going to talk about wines that are available for normal people to buy, not necessarily $100 bottles of wine that you have to
go
through
this
hell and high
top,
water to find.
Yeah, this is our top shelf, 35. And we should, you know, find ourselves drinking a lot of 25, 20.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go 20 or lower.
So that's one of the things we're going to talk about. But
hey,
while I research
this
guy,
and the cracker, Andy, have you tried the cheese and the cracker and wine at the same time? Once this flavor profile of cheese fills your mouth,
here we go.
Hit the wine and let's see what that does. We're having olive oil hard Italian crackers, as I've said. We're having very mild organic white cheddar.
Oh,
and
God,
cheddar
that's good.
Is not the greatest wine cheese in the world, but I think it's going to be great with this wine, which I thought was going to be a bit fruitier and jammier.
Oh,
I am so
good.
Impressed with
like
BV right now. And their grounds are stunningly beautiful, romantic, not ostentatious. They're very charming and classic, and I don't know. It's just I'm swooning over this company now.
And by the way, this podcast is available for sponsorship. Just kidding.
But not
I mean,
from wine creators, because you can't pay me to like your wine.
No, not from Jimmy, old man, whatever that guy's name is.
No, I had a not very good experience with wine enthusiasts. And they were, you know, that my writer was very sweet, and she was really wonderful, wonderful lady. And boy, I sent them a lot of different kinds of photos, and the ones they chose to put in were consistently basically dead air. And, you know, knowing a lot of wine magazine subscribers, I know that the great writing was not going to be read nearly as much as the empty room pictures. It was insane. I had, you know, those great, you know, a swoosh to the colors of the shirts and the candlelight and the, you know, captured in motion, joy and flame lit wine bar, and none of them showed up. So
it was an empty bar. We're talking about your article in Wine Enthusiast. Is that what we're discussing
the
here?
Only wine magazine I can think of that's done an article on my wine bar, which I thank them immensely for. But I did send my writer a note, the wonderful, brilliant lady, and say, what in the heck is going on with the picture selection? Can you tell your photo editor happy 90th birthday?
It's a common thing in publishing. I mean, that's, you know, I started on Milwaukee.com 26 years ago. When you write a restaurant review, or you got to have some people in the photos, or kind of an empty room sort of. That's not exactly what you want to portray, especially if you're giving it a good review.
I think there might have been a bit in the photo editor who probably wasn't 90, who probably didn't just turn 90 that day. There was a little bitterness in that, like, who is this punk think he is? You know,
fair.
Like,
maybe
what,
it's not a
Dan, give,
maybe it's not
care.
A Dandy Warhol's fan. You know?
Beer, Jack, yeah. Yeah.
You want to hear what kenswineguide.com has to say about this wine?
Why? Where do you get all these completely
I don't know. I'm just fucking Googling
no.
it. I don't know.
No, don't say that again. No, we're sticking to James Suckling and all Jeff right. Dunnick. I love this wine.
Really? You've had a lot of wine.
And a lot of, because of my Bordeaux, I love Bordeaux. Bordeaux is Cab Sauv, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot. Generally, that's it. And some are wholly Merlot. I think St. Julien are the region, or the appellation that only does Cab Sauv, or only does Merlot. And Bordeaux, we'll get to Bordeaux later, but I've got an amazing, funny story experience that was my first Bordeaux. Yeah, right. What do we got more important shit to talk about right now, man.
Well, first I'll tell you what Jimmy Suckling has to say about it. He gave it, Jimmy gave it a 92.
Okay.
He said it's a firm and silky red with blackberries and currants, as well as iodine and redwood undertones.
He must have had a snake bite like on his leg, walking through the vineyard.
Or exposed to nuclear.
He fixed it.
Fallout.
Or whatever you do, whatever iodine fixes. He had that problem. He poured it on his leg. I don't know. I don't know.
Could you isolate the flavor of iodine? I could not. I've never licked iodine before.
I don't know what it tastes like. I can't even remember what it smells like. And we're of that age where mom, dad, or scoutmaster probably put it on our
shit on you.
Put it on our wounds. You
it's
know,
orange, I think, right?
As a 10, 9, 10, 12, I don't know, year old.
So he says iodine and redwood undertones, like the tree.
Okay.
I guess. Don't get that. Not that I don't taste it, but I also don't know what a redwood tastes like. There aren't any redwoods in the places I've lived.
There aren't any redwoods in Wisconsin.
No.
There are.
I lived on the East Coast too, but
I can't say that because there are redwoods in Oregon.
You ever lick one?
I've never eaten nor even licked one.
Okay. So he could be right, James Suckling. He says it's medium-bodied, creamy, and delicious. Shows real Napa character.
Old school Napa character, not the new or kind of recent school Napa character. No, this is there is a woody thing going on there.
I can taste the wood part. I don't know if I could isolate it to redwood.
You know,
specifically.
There's a thing called whole cluster maceration, which is a vaguely sexual orientation to it. But that's where they leave stems in. And now when it sits in the tank with all the bits still in it, everything's in. The grapes are all mushed and in. The stems are in. Okay. And you'll see that in wine talk a lot. So this has a whole cluster sort of high mid-range before you get up there, but above the actual fruit acid itself, in between the chalky tannins and the acidic nature of fruit juice, there is a flavor that is brought on in a major way by whole cluster. And I think those are just meant to not drink. They're just meant to put in your cellar. And when your grandkids are born, you pull it out and you drink it. And takes, particularly for Cab Sauv, which in the old days, I think before World War II, was only used as a blending grape. I've been told that, but I've been told a lot of things. We all have now, haven't we? By the internet, mostly. I did not read that on the internet, though. I was told that probably at the old wine guys.
Right. So obviously this podcast is called Wine Acoustics, but note that you keep talking about things, about these wine notes, I think other people might call them, I guess. I don't know. But you're talking about them in very specific
tones. Tones,
like audio, like you're talking mid-tones, high tones.
Yeah, that's how obviously you discuss music. If you're a mixer, it's mastering actually, where you just push in low mids, lows, high mids, you know.
So you're speaking your own language and applying it to wine.
Yes, I always wanted to be a wine drinker. I'm a huge fan of Victorian literature and 19th century literature. And there's a lot of wine in them, their hills. And then their pages.
But like when you started touring, you just drank whatever, you know, got you drunk, right? You weren't a wine guy necessarily.
No, but I wanted to be. And so before we started touring, when I made a video for $500 that MTV played at its peak hour of its cool band show on two Saturdays in a row, and that was a bidding war. It incited a bidding war between a lot of major labels, which was great because we were an indie band. we had done it all ourselves. We had recorded ourselves. I had made the video, and we could sign with a label that knew we were not going to go into a studio owned and ran by somebody else, run by somebody else. We were going to record ourselves, and we would use our budget not to rent time, but to buy equipment. So the way they try to get you to sign with their label is make a lot of promises about money, freedom, but more importantly, they take you out to expensive ass restaurants and they buy you expensive ass wines. And if it's 1996, which it was in our case, Napa Valley fruit bombs were exploding. So when a $900 bottle of wine showed up at the table and I didn't like it, and I remember one of those specifically, and Ron Lafitte, who was great, and trying to sign us to Elektra Records, which was run by Seymour Stein, the legend, who had signed the Ramones, the Cult, Madonna. You know, he was the ears of the coolness of the 80s. And he said, "What don't you like about this wine?" Because obviously I didn't like it, you know. I said, "The bottom end is flabby. It sounds like old white guys, bald white men trying to play funk with Ray-Bans on at 11 p.m. indoors." I worked at that nightclub, by the way, as the doorman for
so you
three
know,
and a half
you
years.
Speak of experience here. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. I speak from precedent and experience on this one.
Okay.
And then I said, the high mids are too aggressive. The high end is in, you know, is making me blind. And, besides that, you know, I'll drink it.
And yeah, so let me set the stage here. Yeah, go ahead.
And he said,
yeah.
"Wow, you know a lot about wine." And I said, "No, I just know a lot about describing a sensory experience." But those are all music, obviously. We, you know, I don't want to drivel on about it. But
no, that's okay. But let me set the table
tones,
here.
The tones, the acoustics of wine, which is why you came up with a great idea to call it that. Or the good idea to call it that, if you want to look,
if we change it, right?
Right, yeah. Wine resonation. Wine resin.
Well, I already made the logo.
Wine resin.
Don't make me change it. Let me set this. Let me just set the stage here. All right, so you're like 26 or something, 27.
Yeah.
You and Pete and Zia and probably Eric at that point.
Yeah, Zia's 19. Yeah.
Right. So you guys are like a bunch of like, you know, yahoos who are drinking $1,000 bottle of wine and you got,
and
like,
complaining
like,
about
a,
it.
Complaining about it as you
but
know.
Specifics, but complaining specifically right. about it.
And I imagine that happened a couple times and you're just like, ugh, just give me a, I don't know, gin
Coke,
tonic or something
Coke.
Or Coke or
Coke
like
on ice. I love Coca-Cola on ice. They can like sponsor this, by the way, because I'm a huge fan. You know, there is star anise in that concoction.
Really?
It comes from the great era of snake oil salesmen, where if you put, you know, cocaine
in, helps probably
in your,
to sell
in your health producing elixir, you know, but they also put great things in it, like star anise, and it's a secret recipe, and you can't find it online. Trust me, I've looked.
No, you can't. Like, it's like only two people know at a time. They can't like fly together in case I don't know.
Yeah,
that could also.
Yeah.
I did not hear that on the internet. I heard that before the internet.
It's so
true.
Cool. You heard it from Anton. We used to say that before the internet existed. We used to say, "Who told you that, Anton?"
Anton. Yeah. I was trying to avoid that. I don't know. I was trying
Anton
not to bring up Anton.
A myriad of arcane and bizarre information. Of course, now with the internet, unfortunately, the spell is broken and we're always wondering if anyone says anything or you read it in print. Where's your bibliography on that one?
Hey, can we get back to the
amazingness of the crackers here?
Yeah.
And the cheese.
I like the combination's tremendous. You're exactly right.
Yeah. And usually, and people don't think about cheese as being tangy unless you're like kind of a cheese guy or a cheese gal or a cheese
person.
And this is not that tangy, but tangy things do not agree with wine very well. Another thing to be aware of, vinegar does not agree with wine because corpses are not invited to parties of the living. And vinegar is dead wine. So.
Should you make that up?
If you, just now. Actually, and if you need to have a lovely vine experience with like a salad, make sure the vinaigrette is the tiniest bit of a lovely vinegar, mostly driven by olive oil, the dressing, a little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, and get bubbles.
You are the funniest kind of nerd because you actually know exactly what you're talking about. Like if someone else said this, I'd be like, but you're right. I mean, like all this makes total sense. Courtney.
Yeah. Bubbles are also great with hamburgers. Very hard to find a wine that goes with pickles, ketchup, you know.
I'm going in.
Cracker.
God, I just did. It's delicious. While you nibble on that. We got to get this story briefly out of the way because I think it's really fascinating. It doesn't have to be a long one because I know it already. But you did have this transformation from when you went to thinking wine was meh to when suddenly you decided that the heavens parted.
Imagine my disappointment. Oh, an entire young person's lifetime of thinking I was going to grow up and drink great wine.
That's how I feel.
And then I found out that I don't even like $1,000 bottles of wine. I was horrified and depressed.
It's a cool thing, and you want to appreciate it. And I'm still learning. I'm 50 years old, and I'm still like, now I'm getting it. But I've drank enough wine to, you'd think I'd understand it.
Can I jump forward? Three years.
Please.
Now, if I wake up on a European tour. And nobody else wants to get up and go eat, that means we partied super hard. Fathead doesn't want to party, doesn't want to eat. Poopy doesn't want to eat. Nobody's getting up with me. So I'm wandering around an empty, small city, large town, beautiful espaliered trees and this arcade down the middle of the roads as they do in France, where the side going one way is separated from the side going the other way by grass strip planted with something beautiful in this place. It was that. Nothing's open, so it must be around 2:45 in the afternoon. Most southern European countries take siestas. It's not just Spain. Just FYI.
No, it's a way to be.
So
support it.
Eat, you know, around noon or before for your lunch and don't expect to get anything else. Well, all of these empty places with the chairs up on the tables were actually making me very depressed on the topic of depressing. And then there's a older gentleman, drying glasses, washing glasses in the sink, drying them, putting them up on the shelf, looking at, you know. And I walked in and, you know, manger avec un bon vin rouge, a good red wine, and eating, please, s'il vous plaît. And
ça va.
And he said, you know, grumpy guy. And I probably looked like hell. And I sat behind him at the bar while he continued ignoring me. This was the vibe.
Très French. Very French.
Very provincial French. Not very Parisian.
To be clear, Parisian. You didn't even know what city you were in at this point, right? Because the tour bus just showed up somewhere.
Absolutely not. I probably guessed as to what country I was in. But if you say that in it's Italy, they'll probably think you're French and speak to you in English, you know, halting, cool accent English. So he tears off baguette. He reaches up, feels a few bottles like he's Kim Deal feeling tall boys on top of her Marshall stack, and picks maybe the heaviest one, like she would, and pours some into like a little water glass. And then, avec de l'eau, s'il vous plaît, yes, water goes, and avec beurre, with butter.
Right.
He looks at me and just shakes his head, like, what a dumb guy. And so okay. Now, at this point, I'm just guessing that I will like the wine, and I probably ordered it just to spend an extra $5, because really all I wanted was some bread and water. And I wanted our food to show up backstage. That's what I wanted, actually. And it wasn't there. And I got into the venue, and I remember that it wasn't there. And I know exactly what the area looks like, or looked like then, where the food was going to show up, and it wasn't there. And it's empty in my mind still to this day, because 6 hours later, I saw food, probably great cheeses, cool wines, fruits, sandwiches, you know. Okay, probably a great baguette, because it was France. And the wine, I ate the bread, and I hit the wine. Oh, my dad. I was in the 1800s, and I was having a French experience. It was insane. It was every literary twist and turn around the great poets and their love of this poet's high made by great wine. And I said, what the hell wine is this? Well, I probably said, excusez-moi first.
Excusez-moi, qu'est-ce que c'est?
And he said,
he
didn't say. Actually, he turned around first and gave me one of these, you know. And then he said, Bordeaux. And I just... Oh, I saw that in the tour book. That's where we are today. We're playing Bordeaux tonight. Is the color, is the wine, is the town. It's, oh my God, it's from, this is all, I love Bordeaux wine. I have no idea what wine that was. There weren't cameras on cell phones. There probably weren't, frankly, even cell phones back then. I don't know.
What tour was this, do you know? This was,
I don't know, 98, 99, something like that, I guess.
Maybe?
I have no idea, dude.
I mean, I'm just trying to picture, like, what album you were. It was before.
The Dandy Warhols Come Down. We were still on that. The big hit was Not If You're the Last Junkie on Earth. Mm-hmm. And then Boys Better followed that. Every Day Should Be a Holiday. England, we were banging in England.
I love that
and
album.
They sort of ran the roost. In Europe as well for influencing.
I love that story, and I love that album, and I absolutely noticed that you dropped a Kim Deal reference from the Breeders, who I also saw at Summerfest two summers ago.
The same record, The Dandy Warhols Come Down, has a song called Cool as Kim Deal.
That's what I was going to say. That was one of the first dandy songs I ever heard. And I was like, they appreciate Kim Deal enough and the Pixies enough to make a song tribute to her.
Our new record has...
You have Frank Black, right?
Frank Black, yeah. Is his rock star name. One of his two
Black
rock
Francis,
star names.
Frank Black, depending on which era we're talking about.
Yeah, I like to call him Black Francis, going all the way back, you know. Actually, what I really like calling him is by his real name, because it makes me feel so cool to be on.
I don't know if I know his real name.
Are we first, and then I'm not telling you.
Okay.
I love to I'll be on those internet. Terms with such a superhero, amazing artist. It's my giddy fanboy moment. You know,
I'm wearing a Space Hog t-shirt because the drummer of Space Hog, Sia, both
gave it to you.
Leads. No, he blogged for me. He's Johnny Craig's a friend of mine, and he did some writing on Milwaukee, and we did a kind of like a version of Song Exploder, which is my segue to this next thing and why I asked you what album this is on, because you will notice that the intro music to this podcast is Boys Better. One of my favorite Dandy Warhol songs. I also thought it seemed appropriate because we're two dudes just drinking
wine. We're just
wine
two
and talking
boys.
Shit.
Yeah. Just two overgrown boys.
Older man children.
Yep.
But again, the reason I wanted to ask you this, and then we can talk more wine. So I'm just going to exploit you for a second, is I've seen a lot of legendary musicians going on YouTube and teaching people how to play songs. And I know that Duran Duran is also kind of an influence of you guys. They, was it John Taylor who produced?
No. Nick Rhodes, the keyboardist from Duran Duran.
How many glasses are you into this thing? I'm about halfway through the bottle already. It's great.
I'm only down to probably 1 inch below the label, the front label, not the back label. How far are you?
About 2 inches below the front label. Wow, you've been talking more. I've been listening.
Man, you're a great drinker. You don't change at all under the force of two glasses of wine already.
I am a professional, Courtney. Plus, I live
like
in
to
Milwaukee.
I think I am, but really, I'm a lightweight.
Well, come visit me, and we'll fix that. Because Milwaukee is, it's not so much wine, but there's a good wine scene here, but people drink more in Wisconsin
now,
than I've
ever
experienced in my
life. Do you guys just make Milwaukee, is a German, all of Wisconsin is do you
yeah,
only,
but Milwaukee is specifically.
Do you only make Teutonic
wine?
No,
definitely not.
I mean, cheeses. Are there soft cheeses like triple cream brie?
For sure. And okay. I think Wisconsin has, if not the most Gouda. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Rubbery, calcified Dutch cheese. Again, Teutonic as fudge. And
right. Now you're saying fudge. I'm the only one who says fuck on this podcast.
All right, I'll say it later.
Come on, okay.
I promise.
It's Teutonic as fudge.
Uh-huh.
There are people who know...
Teutonic as fug.
Yeah, there are people who know a lot more about cheese here than I do. Here's my question. This is where Duran Duran comes in. John Taylor does this thing on YouTube, and that guy's a spectacular bass player. Like, he is just so good, and he...
Wow. Well, listen to those old records, if I might interrupt you for a second, for 4 seconds.
Go ahead.
Go back and listen to him. Really cool tones. The coolest guitar player of the era was Andy Taylor. Completely unnoticed by the world, except for me and a handful of other people that love cool guitar.
Maybe me.
And good. But John Taylor... I have a feeling with Simon Le Bon's amazing vocals, amazing melodies, and also undersung a great poet. If you want to play guitar, you have to go, and stay out of the way. That leaves Dave Allen from Gang of Four, The Cure, bass-driven. Post-punk was bass-driven, and it allowed for brilliant bass playing to come to the front.
I watched John Taylor give a bass lesson on Rio. I would like you to pull out your guitar for the value to our viewers and our listeners. I want you to tell me how to play Boys Better and how you came up with those chords. And I'll let you talk.
I lied to you earlier. You asked me if I had a guitar, acoustic guitar. And
you don't need one.
No, it's better than acoustic guitar. And this is kind of how I write. And
I'm gonna grab my guitar too here.
All of our songs.
Play along.
Let me see. I have my mini studio here. I have a toy drum kit over there, and I have a inexpensive version of Kurt Cobain's guitar that somebody gave to me. Somebody wonderful, like this amazing company Fender, who have been so cool to us. Okay, EGDA, right? EGDA, easy. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and 2, and 3, and 4, and 1, all the off beats. Now, I was a drummer before in every band. The Dandy Warhols was my first band playing guitar and singing ever. I was a drummer. And I started writing songs because I realized when my first band, New History, N-U History, when that band split up, I realized the songwriter was going to be the hard one to replace. Later, after a lot of tomfoolery for a decade, I realized the singer was also going to be very difficult to replace. So I did that myself, and thus the Dandies. But this is one of the earliest songs. And it's those chords. And there's a really cool, unusually sophisticated sounding farfisa part over the top. It sounds like a real keyboardist, but it's not. It's me. Just doing, right?
I thought that was a keyboard. I thought that was Zia.
No, Zia really didn't know how to play keyboards at the time. She was cool. I wanted her in the band because she really loved music, and she didn't know how to play any instrument. She came into this band with no bad habits musically.
She learned.
Well, she learned how to play, but she learned with
absolute, not the bad habits. She learned
absolute purity. Here's four chords. Do something cool, and she could, you know. And she really, when we worked with Massive Attack, if you know that band,
of course,
that was the first time, you know, Rob 3D and Neil, their engineer. Brilliant, one of the greatest in history. They just went, oh, you know, we want to, we're gonna plug in pedals, we're gonna give you keyboards, you know. Fathead and I just wanted to go to the cider bar down the street. But anyway, so that's when Zia really exploded into a brilliant, you know, because she was always like the George Harrison of the band. Like, hey, I have this idea, maybe, you know, and looking at, you know, Lennon and McCartney, like they're
The way they shat all over George whenever he came up with an idea.
Did they?
Yeah. In the, like, Let It Be documentary, George would be like, I've got an idea. And they'd be like, all right, you know. But obviously he made amazing music.
It ain't going to be no Maxwell Silver Hammer.
I love that song, by the way. I love that whole album.
Yeah, so proud.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, anyway, those are four very simple chords, Courtney.
Everybody knows Paul McCartney was at his best when he was trying to impress John that he could be cool, too.
Did you see that documentary?
What
did you see
the
six-hour
documentary? I've got a good buzz on. Why?
Keep drinking because we've got a little more time left.
Of a goldfish right now.
That's what I'm here for. You got four chords in that song, which are like the first four chords. Someone even learns how to play on guitar. Like I can do that, but why is this song so cool?
And then, just as a relief from that, I didn't want to relinquish that E drone. You can, but the velocity is forward motion the whole way with a little bump here and there that's predictable and nice, enjoyable even. Right, so there's that. And then you go, which is B flat to A to G. Which is, you know, and then the bumpy road again. The occasional bump in the road. Ah, love it. And then just, you know, sing the root note with a harmony on it. You know, and it's just, it's all that driving.
To me, that is like
smoking weed and driving in the desert. Not too fast, but fast.
It's a prototypical Dandy Warhol song. And it, when you hear it, even now, 23 years later, whatever. I mean, it's like, it like sounds like you guys. And it's such a simple song, but you find a way to make it.
They're all
psychedelic
simple.
And
they're all simple.
So thanks for indulging me on that one.
Cool. Yeah. I'm just the folky kind of stoner guy. Pete is the full on acid tripper. He's the one who gets the feedback layers, the swirling, you know, I make a triangle. I make a cross, I make a square, I make a straight line, I make a circle. I make the simplest shapes possible because I enjoy them, and I think we all do. He makes it of, this part is of worms, and this part is of solar flares or whatever. You know, he wants to be tripped out by complexity and depth. I want to be tripped out by stark simplicity.
Maybe that's why the four of you work. I don't know.
Yeah. And Zia just wants to have a pumping groove. And Fathead is kind of a strange blend of all three of the other ones of us, actually.
Speaking of Fathead.
He's the folkiest. He's way folkier than me. So he's, you know, arguably one of the greatest vocal arrangers of our day.
Yeah, and he can sing and play drums at the same time, such as
well, that's a bit of a monkey job, but
that's
but
hard,
in
I
the
think.
Studio where he's doing them separately. Yeah, and it is good. It's live. We're an octopus made up of only four people, but in the studio, yeah, Brent is he is money.
So this is going to be a joke that we come back to over and over again, and that's the concept of drinking a little bit of water while you're drinking wine.
I know. I so told you that I don't
have. We might as well explain what it is. I got some water, and I would like some, but Brent advises against it, right? Fathead does not support the water during the wine.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yes. I told you about that.
Our listeners record, haven't heard about
at
it
our
yet.
Record yeah. release, at our record release party last year, we had been drinking wine for hours and listening and smoking weed and listening to our new record, Rockmaker, super loud on the PA in the big room at the studio. And just, you know, we were in. We were all the way in. We're drinking. And I said, man, there's no one here to make us drink water. We're going to be really hungover tomorrow. And he goes, dude, when I'm on a wine jag, I don't want to drink that shit.
Every time I hear this, it makes me laugh.
And I water just shit. Went, A, that is fecking hysterical.
It's fecking.
And it's B, poignant. It's so true. How weird is it? Water is like, it's like drinking 200, 500 grit sandpaper.
Yeah, what is this?
It is absolutely bone dry. It is jagged on a very fine coarseness, and you just don't want it. I mean, wine is so silky and it's so smooth. And when you're in the groove, and have been for as long as we were, it was a revelation. It was a revelation. It was
revelatory. So you describe the notes on water as sandpaper,
but not coarse
dry,
sandpaper. 500
fine grit
really
sand,
fine, like buffing out optical lenses, like thousandths grit, you know,
I'll ask, whatever. We'll see what Jimmy Suckling has to say about water. See if it, on a scale of, I give this an 89. We want to talk about this wine before we finish this bottle a little bit.
It's not changing very much, is it?
It isn't. So we're going to drink other wines that do change a lot. Like in the next episode, we're drinking some Spanish wine, episode 2.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
But, and that theoretically should change, but I feel like it tastes about the same. Is that weird?
Yeah, it kind of is.
Is it weird that it's staying the same?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't think I've ever known a red wine that is so gorgeous and complex to not just soften up and become like a velvet Elvis. It is still kind of young and green and zesty. But I love it still. It is a really wonderful wine. I'm going to go buy probably 4 more bottles and stick them in my cellar.
How long? So this is a 2020, but this would sit for a while. This would be fine, right?
I have hundreds of bottles similar to this, and but nothing quite this. I will forget about it completely. And in 10 or 12 years, it'll be a 16-year-old bottle of wine. Dude, all of that green sapling vibe, all the stems will go away, the tannins will subdue, and it will be a velvet Elvis. It will be the velvetiest, darkest, smoothest thing. And here's the problem with wines that are wonderful in this young wine way, is that I like filet mignon, and it tastes like almost nothing. And if I'm going to spend, if you go to a great steak restaurant, it's going to be, you know, $70. It's going to be $100, yep. You know, more or less with a tip, to have a perfect filet mignon.
Yeah, people bitch about it too. They say it's not flavorful enough, but I love it.
If you have a wine this strong in flavors, when you take a bite of that filet mignon, you will be chewing on a steak texture this wine, right? Which is why it's great that we're having crackers and this wonderful organic farms.
Yeah, I kind of like a steak right now, to be honest with you.
I know. If we were in the same city, dude, we would be raiding my cellar, and then we would be hitting the ringside restaurant.
Yeah, we're gonna do it. I just want to point out that I actually do have a Velvet Elvis in my podcast studio, and I have an extra one. So when you come to Milwaukee or when I go to Portland, it's got your name on it, Courtney.
Decrease. That's amazing. I will hang it proudly next to the old Dandy Warhol.
It's good.
1996
it's good for
first poster of Capitol Records.
It's good for acoustics, you know, because it kind of absorbs the sound.
It absorbs the high end.
The high ends, right. Like, okay, so yeah, I'm going to tell
you. That's what I'm talking about. Is it'll absorb the tannin,
right?
Sonically, the sonic tannins.
Sonically speaking, I'm going to tell you one more thing, and then I want to.
This is really
fun.
I love your idea of having a wine podcast. I used to
it
be.
It came from drinking a lot of wine.
It. You know, people had always said, you know, are you ever going to do a wine podcast, and are you ever going to own a winery? And I would say, well, to the latter, no, because you can't make 15-year-old wine.
Right, that's
you have
hard.
To make wine and then wait 15 years. So fuck that. I'll just buy the wine 15 or 28 years old or whatever. And then to the other question, I would snobbishly say you can't afford me. But obviously,
I'm
don't
not
care
paying
anymore.
You. We're gonna figure this out on our own. We're gonna make sponsorship. Sponsorship is available, folks, at the Deep Dive podcast. I'm just kidding. This is fun, and I like it because we're drinking wine, we're talking, and hopefully people are going to feel like we're having a conversation.
You're an experienced podcaster.
I'm an experienced journalist, and podcasting is an extension of journalism. It's just a different format.
It is journalism today.
Yeah, exactly. I'm agnostic about the platform.
You made it very easy.
Thank you.
And you're making it very fun and funny. I'm so happy you thought of this and are a pushy, yet not that pushy, enough guy.
I'm a little pushy.
To get me into it.
I'm working on, and plus, okay, just not to sit around and wax each other's cars here, but yeah, you've been giving me some pretty good feedback and vice versa. We're going to get all this microphone shit squared out or squared away. Like, this is going to only get better.
We might have it squared away, or you know what? Because look, you guys, I got this. Oh God, it just went dead.
Don't touch it.
Bad. God.
Feck.
All right.
Did you play with your microphone on stage? Like, come on.
Son of a bitch. Yeah, dude. I move it around. Every song has to be different.
All right.
Just
let it roll. We'll see what happens. Feck. If you guys notice any sort of feck. Did you notice any sort of audio differences? Because Courtney just touched his microphone.
You know why. And don't let that happen to you.
That's part of the tutorial that we just did. I'm going to finish this bottle of wine, by the way.
Oh, my God. It's really fun.
I want to tell you what the blend is.
It's a great drug. They say that they started making Cab Sauv-driven wines only after the Germans had taken over France in World War II. Because being Teutonic, they like those tangy, aggressive, sour,
violent,
tart,
pointy
flavors. They favored really acidic and tannic.
Teutonic
wines, which is great for white wines, but for red wines, you know, Louis Latour is one of the, Chateau Louis Latour is one of the big five. There's, you know, Chateau Margaux. There is, Chateau Lafite Rothschild, there's Chateau Mouton Rothschild, you know. But one of the greats is Chateau Louis Latour. That was not regarded one of the big four. It made it the big five until the Germans came, and they drank so much of it because it was a very acidic and tart. And now, Anton didn't tell me this, but I also didn't read it on the internet. Okay, so let's go back to Chateau Louis Latour. So theoretically, what I was told is that that is when Cab Sauv became not just a blending grape. Like if you see Bordeaux with any Cab Franc or Petit Verdot in it, there's, 5%, 2%. 3%, it's very little. And that's apparently what Cab Sauv used to be. But
can I pull you back in for just a second here? Because we're almost an hour and a half here.
Please do. And it's not going to be easy because I am now caught up with you. Oh my God, ahead by a nose. Look at that.
Are you though? Because I'm at the bottom of the label now.
Oh, God, I have so much respect for you right now.
You monologue a lot, so I have to sit here and do something with myself. And I like your monologuing. Please do not misunderstand that. I respect it and enjoy it. And it's more interesting than mine when it comes to wine.
I am going to be horrified, and I'm going to ask you to please chop out a pant load of it.
I won't make you look stupid, I promise. But I do have to edit this, which is why I'm going to ask you.
Oh, no, you don't. Nobody else can make me look stupid. I just go ahead and do it myself.
Can I ask you the question about the grapes, Courtney Taylor? This is 83% Cabernet Sauvignon, 4% Charbonneau, 4% Petit Syrah, 3% Merlot, 2% Touriga Nacional.
Never heard of that one either.
2% Petit Verdot and 2% Malbec.
Okay, Malbec apparently was the main blending grape and sometimes the main grape of Bordeaux pre-World War II, German occupation. Whatever the first grape after Cab Sauv.
4% Charbonneau.
You never got me.
But can we call this a Cabernet Sauvignon? Because it's 83%?
They do, right on the label.
Okay. Just checking.
God, I love this wine. I am having such a good time. And the very important thing, which is why I don't really drink beer and I don't really drink hard spirits, is the drug itself, the high itself. And I've experimented with many, many highs. And I care a lot about it, about what this or that does to me. I love being altered, but I don't want to be in the grip of something that sucks. And this is probably a high that's going to last for an hour, hour and a half, right?
I don't know. I just finished the bottle. So.
I think it's fun. I think I'm having a good time.
Yeah, me too.
And so, I'm lost in thoughts, and I'm probably, if I sat down and really got to work, I would be a great poet. Obviously, I'm not a Somerset Maugham or a Jules Verne or anything like that, but I think I would be a great writer right now. Having so much fun.
Could you write the theme song to our podcast after, maybe? So we don't have to keep trying to find copyright-free versions of Dandy Warhol songs? Just throwing that out there.
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. All right. To wrap this up, I just finished my bottle. We know that Jimmy Gordon gave this a 93.
Jimmy Gordon. He's an old Gordon, that Jimmy.
And we know that Jimmy Suckling gave it a 92.
Oh, the other Jimmy. Yeah.
What does Jimmy Courtney Taylor Taylor rate this wine?
Jimmy Taylor Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going 92 and a half.
Do they come in half points?
They do now.
On Deep Dive Wine Acoustics, we are going to rate wines to the half percent.
Only.
Never to a whole number, because that's stupid. We're going to be doing this roughly every 2 weeks. Depends on our respective...
Oh, my God. If we get on a jag, we could put out three in 2 days.
We could put out three today, but they might get sloppy.
You mean like this?
Yeah, sloppier. I think if we reviewed another, can you review a bottle of wine after you've had a bottle of wine, or do you lose the ability to objectively discuss?
I don't know.
What does Jimmy Suckling do? He probably has just he's. Spits it out, right? Because he's...
I don't know. I think that if you get onto a second bottle of wine, you have a greater and more focused palate. But
that's one way of looking at it.
At some point, maybe halfway through that, your ability to taste starts to,
degrade.
Yeah, and then a third bottle is awesome.
But just for recreational purposes, not for professional wine reviewing.
Oh, yeah, no, but you don't know that. You really think it's awesome.
I'll try it.
No matter what, I will try it.
I mean, for science, Courtney and Andy what drink three bottles of wine. Nothing, basically.
Yeah.
I would do anything.
I love science, too.
We've insulted Jimmy Suckling.
The Jimmy Gordon.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy Gordon, wine enthusiast.
Holy shit. Good
like
job.
Like and subscribe to Deep Dive Wine Acoustics for the outtakes in which Courtney Taylor, Taylor and I.
You will never see them. Don't do it. Don't do it because he's lying. He will
still like and subscribe.
He will shit in a bag and push himself around with his muscular biceps in a wheelchair if he does.
Like and subscribe for me shitting in a bag and pushing myself around. What am I? The fuck am I doing in a wheelchair? At any rate, thank you for joining us too. Excuse me. Thank you for joining us for the first episode of Deep Dive Wine Acoustics. Courtney Taylor Taylor might be hammered, but he didn't even finish his bottle of wine. He gave this a 92 and a half. I'm giving it 110.
Oh my God. Well, that's because you gave it 110%.
Because that's what I do.
I'm so impressed with you right now. You did a great job.
Courtney's going to go back somewhere in Portland and take a nap.
Silence. Silencio. Por favor. All right. This is amazing. You absolutely had more wine than I did. Wow. That is so cool. I am so impressed. I have fears of drinking too much. I guess I'm culturally shamed, you know, by enjoying wine so much that I don't really want to finish a bottle myself. But I guess I didn't, and you didn't either. We drank our own bottles together.
If you want to rationalize it that way, I support you. And but you talked more.
You talk more
than I did. I had more time to just kind of sit here. You had the stories.
We're only going to be better friends too.
Courtney, thank you. I did give you a cheers, but I got this much left. So,
cheers.
We'll see you on episode 2, Deep Dive Wine Acoustics. Like and subscribe for God's sake. And on episode 2, we're talking Spanish wine. Hope you found this as funny and as weird as we did, because I probably need a nap right now.